attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try.
This year marks 5 years of call to action, and I know, who cares? Well, not many people, perhaps, and rightly so, but to celebrate half a decade of our little show with a big voice, we're re-releasing a choice cut of some of our biggest and best episodes. Back in 2021, we posed as a jester in the throne room of the Burger Kingdom to nab one of the most influential CMOs in the industry, the mind behind the infamous Mouldy Whopper, Fernando Mercado. In his final flame-grilled interview before leaving Burger King for Activision, we pulled up to the next window for lessons with Fer on embracing creativity as a competitive advantage, learned how to help your organization get more comfortable with being uncomfortable, building a culture of creativity, understanding the power of nostalgia, why creativity should always be tied to business objectives and measured against them, and loads more. So feel better about marketing with episode 60 of Call to Action with Fernando Mercado. Welcome to the show, Fernando.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. I was looking forward to this one.
Right, quick fire time, Fernando. Mac or PC?
Mac, for sure.
Sao Paulo or Miami?
Miami.
Ooh, Corinthians or Palmeiras?
No, Flamengo.
Ask for permission or ask for forgiveness?
Forgiveness, always.
Pele or Ronaldinho?
Ooh, Pele, for sure.
Ogilvy or Burnback?
Oh, I would have to go with my friends from Ogilvy, right? I mean, we've done so much cool stuff together. I cannot side with them.
But a big fan of Bill's.
Yes, I'm a huge fan. I'm looking at his book here in front of me. It's a shame it doesn't get printed anymore because lots of people would benefit from reading it.
Yeah, agreed. Right, two more, and it's favorite ads time. So we have Guinness Surfer or Guinness Swimmer, aka Swim Black.
Yeah, Swimmer, Jonathan Glazer wins.
And finally, Mouldy Whopper or Muck Whopper?
Mouldy.
Yes.
But Mac Whopper is, I love Mac Whopper too, don't get me wrong. But Mouldy to me is like next level in terms of making people care about something that usually people don't care.
Yeah. To be honest, the quick fires are often quite unfair because they force binaries, and it's not always the fairest thing to do, is it? But
it's all good. It's all good.
But thank you so much for joining us, Fernando. It's a real pleasure.
No, it's great to be here.
So here at Call to Action, we really like to celebrate the linear and particularly the not so linear routes that guests have taken to get to where they are now. So what was your first ever job and how did that lead to your first proper marketing job?
Oh my God, my first ever job was, believe it or not, I studied mechanical engineering in college. I was always kind of like good with numbers and had also a creative side, but back then in Brazil, I'm Brazilian, there was no like marketing school or like business school, at least none that I knew. So I decided to study engineering. And my first job I got kind of like a scholarship where I had to work with a professor in his thesis around simulation of gas turbines. I still have it here. And I work on that for like a year and a half, 2 years. And then I got an internship in Unilever in the shop floor of a factory in Indaiatuba, which is the countryside of São Paulo. And I worked there for around 2 years in the shop floor of the factory.
Amazing.
That's how it started. And that's where, look, that's where I heard, for the first time I've heard the word marketing. You know, we had like the marketing team coming from São Paulo to present the plans for the brands that we used to produce in the factory. And then I saw the presentation and I was like, oh, that's cool. You know, like they have the business side, but they also have a creative side of design with advertising. Maybe I can do that. And then when my internship was getting to an end, I applied to their management trainee program and I insisted that I wanted to be in marketing. And then the people who interviewed me were crazy enough to believe that I could. And even though I didn't know who Philip Kotler was, they allowed me to get a job in marketing at Unilever.
And I imagine in hindsight, that time on the shop floor actually helped you from a marketing perspective.
It did, actually. You know why? Because like when I started in marketing, they gave me like a relatively small fabric softener brand in Unilever. It's a large brand for the market, but for Unilever, in comparison to other brands that they have, it was small. And they didn't have much budget at all. So I had to do things around packaging, design, and work very close to the manufacturing guys and the supply chain guys, which was the world I knew. And I had automatic respect from them, and they would be extremely helpful and always cheer for me because they knew where I was coming from. So that was actually really, really, really helpful. And it's important that if you're working in business, that you have a holistic view of everything, right? I mean, when if you are a marketeer, to understand the implications of what you do in the factory, in the at Walmart, on the supply chain, on the finance side, I think it's really, really important.
Yeah, totally agree. And in fact, part of the reason we asked that question at the start about first ever jobs is because I think whilst retrospectively there is no right way into the industry, the route of going via the shop floor and having that inside out perception and complete total view, and as you say, understanding of manufacturing and supply is so significant and so easily lost if you jump straight into marketing from, say, a college or university degree.
Yeah, totally true. Look, I mean, when I look at my college degree, like most of the guys were there, like with me in the class, and we're still really good friends. I keep tabs. In fact, I'm talking to one of them like just after this recording. Most of them don't work in engineering, you know. Like, so I think that engineering or a good college, what gives you is like a really good foundation in terms of your structuring, your thinking, delivering against deadlines, building a timeline and managing a project. That's, I think, what we've learned. You know, like, and if you study engineering like me, like, you learn to not be afraid of things because nothing's scary than a calculus 3 exam.
Amazing. And it gives you that, that understanding of numbers and, you know, not just how to understand them, but how to use them.
It helps. Yeah.
I want to jump straight into the topic of creativity as a competitive advantage. So there's a bit of Birnbachism there.
Yeah.
If that's all right, because it's so important and it's a message that has seemingly been lost in recent years, or at least maybe drowned out by the kind of data, some digital sirens and the such. But I think it's fair to say that you have an obsession with creativity. When did that start? Was that prior to your early days with Unilever, or is that kind of materialized over more recent years?
Look, I mean, when it comes to creativity as a topic, not like applied to marketing or to business, I always consider myself to be kind of like a creative guy. You know, I used to love drawing. I still do. So I used to draw all the time when I was in school, like meaning even before high school. I always did well on the art classes and like, and I was always like into like cinema and stuff like that. So I always had like what I would call like a strong creative side. You know, I always enjoyed that. Like I was always the guy who was drawing the t-shirts for the class. You know what I mean? And to me, like when it comes to business, to me, creativity is what makes you, can help you make you different, can help your money go a long way. You know, like if you just go on the path of same or plain vanilla or flat or 100% functional and rational, I don't think that's how people engage with topics. You know, you need creativity to make it stand out. And since we are quoting, since we touched on Birnbach a couple of times, like he used to say, if people don't notice your advertising, everything else is academic, right? I mean, and I think creativity is what can help make people notice, because you are going to do something slightly different than the rest.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. In fact, the quote we used for you in our intro ends with paying attention. And I think that is obviously rings true with your comment there on Birnbach. As a kid then growing up, were you interested in ads and creativity? And one of the reasons I asked that is because not that long ago, you paid homage to Diego Maradona and posted some of your favorite Argentinian ads. We had a brief exchange on Twitter because you actually shared an ad that I had never seen, partly, I suppose, because I'm the other side of the world to where that ad was created. It was for BGH air conditioners, dads in briefs.
Yeah.
And it was utterly glorious. I absolutely adored it.
Man, I love them.
And so was that something you were interested in as a kid growing up?
Not as a kid growing up. Like, I think that when I started in Unilever, I was lucky enough to start. It was around 97, 98 when I started in marketing. And Unilever had like a very strong track record of advertising and amazing agencies. And like the marketing people and the leadership were super inspiring to me. And the brands were really pushing the boundaries when it comes to creativity with Axe, with Degree, Rexona in Latin America, with Omo, which is like a laundry detergent, like that's huge in Brazil. And I always like looked up to that work and thought it was like super exciting. You know what I mean? Like you would go to those like meetings, all company meetings, like with everyone from the company and all areas, and they would show the ads and everyone would get excited, you know, like, so I was like, maybe I think I can do this. You know, I think I can work to develop that type of stuff. And I started to get more interest. And I was surrounded by people that were like-minded. So we used to like leave work, buy some beers and go to a friend's house and watch ads. You know, we would borrow the VHS from the A&D or one show from the agency and would just watch. And it was fun. And I had no idea how to do it, how to brief, how to judge, how to approve, how to produce. But I knew what I wanted. And I really think advertising is an acquired taste. You know what I mean? No one is born knowing how to do advertising. You need to love it and invest time and hopefully like find people who will coach you, which I always did. I was very lucky on that front. And then over time, you're going to learn a lot and you're going to get better and better and better. I used to say that, I still say that it took me 10 years to still like an ad that I did a year after I did it. Because yeah. I would do this stuff and I think like, oh, it's amazing. And then a year later, I would be like, oh my God, what the hell I was thinking? You know what yeah. I mean? Like, because I was learning so fast. So that's kind of like how I developed in the advertising front.
Yeah, I've heard that quote before from you, and it's fantastic, and it kind of rings true my side as well, because you're absolutely right. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, everything's great about that, the fact that it shows progression. It's not a case of looking back and beating yourself up for doing something that you would do differently now. It's a clear sign of growth, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And look, I mean, and that's why learning and developing yourself and going to an environment where people will invest on your learning, it's so important, especially in the beginning of your career. You know, like that's why it's so important that you try to identify the sooner the better. What are the things that like that make your heart race, the things that like get you excited, the things that you love, so that you like spend time on that front. You know what I mean? Like in my case, when I say like, hey, you should get a VHS tape and go grab beers watching ads, it was fun. You know what I mean? Like it was not like, oh my God, I have to go and study advertising. No. We love that. And everyone works so hard, right? I mean, I don't know anyone who says like, oh, I don't work hard at all and I'm successful. Like people work hard. So you better choose something to do that you really love because then as you work hard, you will have fun doing it. And that's what you were doing. And that's what I still do, to be honest.
Yeah, well, that's important, isn't it? That's really nice to hear as well. But one of the reasons, I suppose, again, why we like to ask how people start off is because you're absolutely right that people take all sorts of routes into this industry. In fact, one of the best copywriters I know used to work in archaeology, whereas you get lots of people who have worn like creative hats like me that are more studio-based who would study creativity. But the way I've always understood it is you have your pure creativity, which is your fine art and your painting and so on, and various other kind of arts fit into that category. And then you mentioned about creativity in business. I've always understood that to be kind of applied creativity because you're applying it to achieve a business result and that type of stuff. You know, there's no reason why that would interest you as a kid growing up. You don't understand it. But the bit that's sticky is how memorable and creative and fun the ads are. And that's the kind of the thread, yeah, I think.
Totally.
I'd love to get your opinion on how we make the case for creativity then, because it's hard to describe creativity in, say, a spreadsheet, or it's hard to maybe making a case for it over other types of analytics and data-driven decisions, which have become easier to make over time, albeit not necessarily to the benefit of effectiveness.
Yeah. So look, I mean, I think you can go through two fronts, right? I mean, one which is people see the work that we do, especially with BK, and they see the output of the work, but many times they don't see that there is a method behind the madness. You know what I'm saying? Like the first step that we did here was like to make sure that everyone understood what the brand was about, and what's the tone of voice and the positioning of the brand and all those things. Then we made sure that we aligned on what are our strategic objectives for the company, you know, like, and how to measure them. And when we are looking to ideas, we are always measuring against that. Is this on brand? Does this help me deliver the strategy? And if you do that over time, as you start to make ideas happen, you can basically like show that when you push the boundaries of creativity, you can most often get a better result. You know what I'm saying? Like I always try to bring it back to results. And that's why it's important to define how you're going to measure success, what are the variables that you're trying to change, and all those things. Some projects are more short-term objectives. Some projects are more like sales, like related objectives. Some are more brand attributes objective, but all projects have some sort of objective, you know, like, and then as you start deploying things and pushing the boundaries, hopefully you see that the more you push, usually the better the result. The other thing is like, and if people don't understand that, another way that tends to work is like, just like when people question you, just look at the person. You know what I mean? Like usually that person is wearing a Nike shoe or an Apple Watch or like, and then you like, and like, or in a Lacoste polo, it'll be like, why do you choose that? You know what I mean? Like, I can build an argument that the Samsung watch is better technically than the Apple. Like, why did you pick Apple? You know, like, why did you pick Lacoste and didn't pick Polo? You know, like, isn't it funny that they are doing better creative work? You know what I mean? Like, than the other brand? Like you see what I'm saying? Like, I always try to make it, like, we sometimes put the hat of businessman or businesswoman, and we forget that we are also consumers, you know, like, and sometimes bringing the person back to, hey, look at what you're consuming, you know, why is that? Can be like, can have that like enlightenment moment, you know what I mean? Like people are like, oh, yeah, it's kind of true, right? Like I'm buying stuff that actually the brand is doing good creative work.
Yeah, no, that all makes complete sense. I like that idea as well, bringing it back to the individual and having a look at, you know, their Apple Watch, etc. I think it's difficult, though, in terms of measuring creativity, especially when it comes to short time spans, because, you know, I've heard someone else recently saying something about, well, how much do you love your wife? And can you plot how that love has grown over years? And it's creativity is one of those things that I think inherently a lot of people understand works and has significant business effects. But it, translating it into maybe we all, I always think we should all learn how to speak the language of the CFO and the finance department.
For sure. But at the same time, it's still on the wife metaphor. Like, imagine you're proposing to your wife. Yeah. You can propose in a creative way or in a flat way. Which is the way you think she will remember 20 years from now? You know what I'm saying? Like, creativity makes everything better. You know, like, and I think that if you don't believe on that, it's because you didn't see great creative in front of you yet, and saw the results that can bring in all fronts, you know, like whether you are not for profit, whether you are a for profit company, whether it's like how you're going to organize the Easter hunt, the egg hunt for Easter for your kids, or like it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Like creativity always makes things better.
Yes, agreed. 100% agreed. You talked about positioning there, and I think Burger King is a great example, especially when it comes to positioning against competitors. I've heard you talk about the challenger mindset that you've kind of got within the culture of Burger King, and that there's probably parallels there, although I don't want to make assumptions, with Burger King maybe going after market share versus market growth, for example, and taking that you know, strong stance and mindset. How do you start to create that culture of creativity, or how did you do that when you first joined Burger King? Or was it already there, do you think?
Burger King is a brand that has been in the marketplace since 1954. If you go back to the first ads around the Whopper, you would see that it's pretty competitive and challenging and challenger type of advertising. It's like black and white, old school ads, okay? I think that there was a period where Burger King clearly was a challenger brand, like creating ways of pop culture, which was the period that CPB was doing the work. And that's like 12, 13 years ago. Don't quote me on that, but it's around that time. And then after CPB, there was like basically like lots of different agencies, different positionings, like different positionings at the same time, bad client behavior, you know what I mean? Like, and I think we didn't do work that was to the level that the brand deserved. And then when we started doing the work around 7 years ago, the ambition was like, well, let's go back to do work that is as great as the work that CPB used to do. You know, like when they were at their best, like with Whopper Freakout, Whopper Virgins, Whopper Sacrifice, Sub-7 Chicken. They could go on and on and on talking about that. But you don't start, the first project that you do when you want to reignite that, it's definitely not Moldy Whopper, right? I mean, you need to build your credibility. You need to make the case for creativity, which was like one of the previous questions you were discussing. I use a lot as a metaphor, like the cliff divers on Acapulco. You know, I don't know if you've been to Acapulco in Mexico, but like there is like a massive cliff, and they have these guys that jump from the cliff in a very like thin, like very straight, like narrow, like a water from the sea, and once I had a chance to talk to them, and I asked how the hell you learn how to do that, and the guy looked at me and said, well, we don't start from here, right? I mean, we start from back there, like 1 meter, 2 meter from the sea, and then you climb your way up as you start to get more confident. They also told me like that. I asked like, so you're not afraid of jumping from here? And he's like, well, I am afraid. I'm afraid every time, but I jump anyway. And to me, that's what it is. You know, like you want to start small. Start with a social media post, a print ad, maybe a radio ad. Make the case, show that the creativity is delivering the result in a better way than the stuff that you used to do in the past. Then do another time, do two together, more examples, build your credibility and start to climb that cliff. And understand that part of your job as a marketeer or CMO is to help the organization become more comfortable with being uncomfortable. Because if you are going to do stuff that's creative, there will always be a certain degree of fear or being uncomfortable. Because creativity to do something that's different, comes with uncertainty. And uncertainty triggers a little bit of fear and anxiety. So that's kind of like the work that we've done here. You know, like Moldy Whopper is jumping from the top of the cliff, which doesn't mean that we are fearless. We are like shitting our pants like on that jump. But we did it anyway. And I think that's the trick. Time, weather, and
always. We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on proper marketing strategy. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
And it's probably the world's simplest idea. I call it the golden circle.
Yeah, golden shower more like. You don't want Simon Sinek, you want a proper marketing chat, don't you? Hang on.
Comfortable with being uncomfortable. It's lovely. Do you think that's a key part of how the role of the CMO is either changing or just a key part of it, I suppose?
I think that the best CMOs I know they managed to influence the organization to go into that direction. You know, like I think that the role of the CMO increase in size and scope. You know, it goes beyond just driving short-term sales, and most CMOs are involved with D&I, they are involved with sustainability. They are the brand stewards. Like they push the organization to take a certain angle on things, and they end up like becoming the right-hand arm of the CEO when it comes to positioning the brand, like employee engagement and all those things.
I also think it can help to frame creativity slightly differently, because, you know, our evolutionary instincts tell us to avoid risk for our own kind of survival, but yeah. Actually being creative is completely and powerfully smart, and our aim really needs to be kind of boringly effective, and it's everyone else who does the same thing and doesn't take risks. They're actually, ironically, the risk takers in some respects.
Yes, I mean, it's a quote from Zuckerberg, right? I mean, the biggest risk is not taking any risk. When something goes wrong, it doesn't have a big impact. When something goes right, you can hit a home run. Trying to do something that's different may not necessarily result in a better outcome, but at worst, in the worst case, it will be flat. And flat tends to be the most common outcome of when you do something that's not different. You know what I mean? So you may as well try to do something different, something creative, because that's the only way, you know?
I also heard you say if you don't feel uncomfortable about it, it's probably not a good enough idea, which I love. What are the kind of biggest risks that you think you've taken in your recent career?
Well, I think Modi Whopper, the thing is, like, I don't even see it as a risk, to be honest with you. I always felt that my organization has my back. My CEO has my back. They understand what we're trying to do. Everyone does. Everyone trusts. And if something doesn't work well, it will be like, okay, what are the learnings? Let's do better next time. Moving on, you know? When I think about what were the most different things I've done in the recent past, surely Modi Whopper and Whopper the Tour ranked very high. But we did things like burning stores. We did Whopper Neutrality. We did Hamburgers. We did Mac Whopper, which you touched. We did Google Home of the Whopper. We did so many things that were very different and very daring for their time. That it's almost like we got used to it, you know, like we got used to feeling uncomfortable with ideas that are very disruptive. And that's a good thing, I suppose.
Yeah, fantastic. I'm mindful of time. We've a couple of listener questions I'd like to put to you.
Cool, let's do it.
So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger, but that's not stopped us. And we have two for you, starting with a fellow Call to Action alumni and creative director of Peter and Paul, Lee Davies. And Lee, he's referencing the new brand identity rollout, which is, I guess, a couple of months old now. He says the new brand seems to use nostalgia as its starting point. Was that a risk in a world whose attitudes towards food, eating meat, the ecological impact of beef, etc., was that a risk, given it's changing all the time, that attitude?
Yeah, well, let me disentangle that, because I think that there are two questions on that question. One is I honestly don't see the design as nostalgic. You know, the brand is a brand with heritage. It's a brand that has been in the marketplace since 1954. The design, the ambition of the design was to be an instant classic. You know, we were trying to accomplish things that usually don't fit well in the same sentence. We wanted to be classic and modern. You know what I mean? Because we know that when you hit that, it becomes more timeless. That was what was kind of like the mindset behind the design work. And we also, as part of that, wanted to make sure that we were portraying the brand as the brand at its best. You know, and the brand is like a 50s kind of brand. When it comes to sustainability, nutrition, all those things, we have very strong streams of work to address that. You know, we launched a framework that we call Restaurant Brands for Good, which has three pillars: food quality, plant sustainability and people and communities. On food quality, we are removing all artificial ingredients from all our food globally. For the three brands, not just Burger King, we have a nutritional roadmap. Moji Whopper is part of that, right? On planet, we have like an infinite number of like initiatives to reduce our environmental footprint. We are global leaders on plant-based burgers. So like the initiatives are happening, and because they are happening, we wanted to signal to people that this brand continues to evolve and is different than what they have in mind. And that's why we made the visual identity change at the time we did, you know, like because it's almost like a bow on top of like many other things that we are working on. So I don't see it as contradictory, and I see it as more like a timeless design that's classic and modern and comes to show that this brand is in constant evolution. Does that make sense?
Yeah, completely. I mean, to be honest, in my own brand management kind of training, heritage was always, you know, a key place to look and almost obsess over, quite rightly. Otherwise, you end up, you know, changing direction and it doesn't make any sense from a brand perspective. Awesome. Question two is from a very smart MA student called Christopher Kelly. And Christopher asks, given the outdated and arguably damaging state of education in the field, what advice do you have for those aspiring strategists and marketeers looking to have a positive impact on the industry?
Get a job in a place that people care about you learning and developing yourself. You know, like that would be my first advice. You know, like I think that I used to read even more, but I always read a lot and I watch ads like nonstop, and especially try to research a bit the history of the ads, who shot, what was the production house, like how did they come up with the idea, what was the agency, when you said Guinness swimmer, I knew who the director was, you know, and we didn't rehearse that, we didn't share that question in advance with me, but like I like the space, so I'm obsessed about it. You know, like not because I have to, but because I love. I was lucky to be in several places and work with several agencies where people really invested time to coach me and to train me. And I was always completely obsessed about learning. So that would be my advice. You know, like you're probably not to become rich on your first job. You know, like so focus on like finding a place that where is a fertile environment for you to learn. That's how I would go about that one.
The final part of our interview then, Fur, is our four pertinent poses that we put to all of our guests, starting with, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Advice to my younger self? I think I would probably say, especially in the beginning of my career, like be more patient. You know, like things are going to happen and sometimes you need to be a little bit more patient but things are going to happen. If you continue to work hard and deliver results, good things are going to come your way. I used to become very anxious and very impatient and I even suffer a bit when people got promoted before I did or when people had an opportunity that I felt was better than the one I was having. And sometimes the reality is that sometimes people are just on the right place at the right time. And if you focus on doing your job, on delivering your results and learning and growing, on the long run, you will be given the opportunities that you deserve. I would have suffered less.
Yeah, I think we all would have done. Number two, then, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
From the industry advertising? Or from life?
Well, if you feel particularly passionate about one or the other, then go with that.
Yeah, man, I hate cancel culture. I hate it. And I think that it creates the wrong behavior and mindset on people. I feel that people read the headline and they don't go deeper to understand what's behind. And they start to wanting to cancel a brand or people. And I just dislike that with passion. Like, I'm very positive about our industry, you know, like I'm not one of those people who are like constantly criticizing the industry and saying that this year is worse than the previous one. Like, I see lots of people doing that. I mean, I told you that, like, I'm Brazilian, I'm hopeless optimistic. I think that things are getting better or will get better always.
Well, I mean, being Brazilian, you've won the World Cup numerous times, so you have to sympathize with us poor sods over here.
Well, that was a while ago.
Yeah, true. Number three, are there any books that you can recommend to our listeners?
Well, since we touched on it, the Bill Bernbach book, I think it's amazing. It's by Bob, I think it's Bob Levinson. I probably butchered his name. It's not being printed anymore, but if you go on Amazon, you can buy a used copy. That's what I did. I simply love that book, you know, like, and I can read it again and again and again. And so I'm always learning something. And even though it was written many years ago, it feels very modern and it feels very relevant today.
Totally. Quick story. I've actually got that book here right next to me, and I think some listeners will know already because I've had quite a few envious tweets about it. But I was lucky enough to find it on a US thrift store website.
Nice.
And the packaging, the postage and delivery to the UK was more than the book itself. So I really lucked out. But the best thing about it is when it first arrived and I was flicking through it, my 5-year-old daughter came over and sat with me, and she genuinely laughed about several of the ads and enjoyed it, and seeing the look on her face,
it's awesome,
despite not being able to read some of the words or understand or clearly have no knowledge of the brands, just showed how brilliant it was.
Yeah, it's a visceral reaction, right? I mean, and if you cannot get hold of that book, but if you search on Amazon, you probably can find a used one. But if you cannot get hold of that one, the copy book from the D&D is also like one of my favorites. And that one is easy to find. It's not that expensive. Totally worth getting it and going through it.
And then number four, we always dedicate every episode to someone, and we bestow or hospital pass that honor to our guest who has to give the reason why. So would you kindly dedicate this episode?
Oh my God. Like, well, since we spoke about him so many times, I think this one goes to Bill. Right? I mean, thanks for inspiring us from wherever you are, up there in the sky. Thanks for inspiring us to do great creative work. Thanks for being brave, for showing us that even when you put product at the center, you can do something that's creative.
What a great dedication. We've never had, Bill's never been the chosen dedication, so it is with great pleasure that this episode is dedicated to Bill Bernbach. As a final call to action, then, everyone listening can head over to calltoaction.co, and we'll share links to everything, including the books that Fur has kindly recommended. How else can people get more Fernando Machado?
Well, I'm very active on Twitter, and I try as much as I can to engage on keynotes and I'm part of the One Club for Creativity. I am on the advisory council for Cannes. I am on the board of Miami Ad School. So it's not that difficult to find me out there. But if you don't want to search, just follow me on Twitter and you'll see that I post all the time.
It's been a real pleasure and a real privilege. So thank you for joining us so much.
No, thanks for having me. It was fun. I could keep going. Maybe we can do another one in the future.
Oh, happily. If you are one of the dozen T-Thousillion who regularly lends us your ears, have tuned in to any or all of our 138 episodes, are one of the over 500,000 listeners and downloaders, or have been lured or bullied into guesting, sent in a listener question, tuned in to hear the answer, recommended us, left the review, thought about leaving a review but haven't, or anything in between, we salute you. Thank you for supporting this little show with a big voice. And in the meantime, seriously, leave a review on Apple and or Spotify if you have a moment. Thank you.